So today we're looking at Dhammapada verses 296 to 301, which read as follows. Supabuddhang pabujjanti sada gotama savaka ye sang divacha ratocha nichang buddha gatasati. Supabuddhang pabujjanti sada gotama savaka ye sang divacha ratocha nichang dhamma gatosati dhamma gatasati. Supabuddhang pabujjanti sada gotama savaka ye sang divacha ratocha nichang sangha gatasati. Supabuddhang pabujjanti sada gotama savaka ye sang divacha ratocha nichang kaya gatasati. Supabuddhang pabujjanti sada gotama savaka ye sang divacha ratocha ahinsaya ratomano. Supabuddhang pabujjanti sada gotama savaka ye sang divacha ratocha bhavanaya ratomano. So 6 verses today. The meaning is almost the same for each one. The meaning is, well awakened are Gotama's disciples who by day and by night, for whom mindfulness is always focused on the Buddha, always focused on the Dhamma, mindfulness is always focused on the Sangha, mindfulness is always focused on the body, and for whom both day and night the mind delights in harmlessness, and for whom by both day and by night the mind delights in development. So these are 6 verses taught in response to a story about 2 young boys. The story goes that in Rajagaha, when the Buddha was living in that area, there were these 2 boys who used to play ball together. They had this game, doesn't explain the details of the game, but it was a game with a ball. And it was a competition. And the one boy whose family was a follower of the Buddha, and the other boy's family was a follower of some other religion. So the boy whose family was a follower of the Buddha used to shout when he was playing ball, when he was about to throw the ball, Namo Buddhasa, homage to the Buddha. And then he would throw the ball. The other boy, who was a follower of some other religion, would copy him, but instead he would say Namo Arahantasa, homage to the worthy one. Somehow that was the name of the leader in their religion. But the second boy noticed that somehow the boy who shouted Namo Buddhasa always came out on top, always won the game. And so over time, as they continued to play ball together and he realized he was losing all the time, he understandably decided to switch strategies and copy the other boy. And as a result, he became an ardent supporter or follower of the Buddha, I guess you could say, respecting the Buddha all the time. So when they would play ball, he would also shout, Namo Buddhasa. And he noticed, I guess he noticed that his ball playing got better. It doesn't actually say that, so it's not clear that it actually does make you a better sports player. But nonetheless, due to superstition or whatever, this boy decided to change and became a person who reflected on the Buddha constantly. Namo Buddhasa became his motto as well. He was the son of a wood collector. His father would go off into the forest with a big cart, collect wood, bring it back to the city, sell the wood, make his living that way. And one day he took his son out of the city into the forest, collected all the wood that they could, came back and stopped outside the city at a pleasant area next to a charnel ground, which I guess was a pretty common thing in India at that time, a place where they would just throw dead bodies. But otherwise it was quite a beautiful, pleasant place to rest. And so he unhooked his oxen from the cart, let them roam, made dinner for them, for the two of them, and sat down to rest for the evening outside of the city. But as it happened, the oxen followed other people's oxen into the city, and he realized his oxen had disappeared, so he told his son to wait by the cart, and he went into the city to find his ox. He found his oxen, brought them back to tried to bring them back to the cart, but couldn't find his way back to the gate and got lost in the city. As a result, he was stuck in the city, and the conclusion, the point is that this young boy ended up alone outside the city with his father trapped in the city when the gates closed, because at night they would close the city gates, not let anyone in or out. And the son was forced to spend the night alone next to a charnel ground, which is a pretty scary place for anyone. Many people are scared of these sorts of places, superstitious or believing in ghosts, spirits. And it so happens that in this charnel ground there were two spirits living who, for whatever reason, were attracted to the dead bodies, eating them or feeding off of them or whatever. And they came across this young boy lying underneath the cart. He had gone underneath the cart, spread out a mat or something, and went down to try and sleep under the cart alone. And they saw this young boy, and one of them said, "Oh, this one looks delicious. Why don't we eat this one?" And the other one shook his head and said, "I don't think that's a good idea." The story says that one of them was wrong view, was a spirit that had wrong view. The other one was a spirit that had right view, and so he thought it was a bad idea, thinking it can't be right to eat a living body. We should stick to the dead ones. But the one with wrong view couldn't be dissuaded, and he reached under the cart and grabbed the boy by the leg and started to pull him out, thinking this would be a tasty meal. The boy, having recited the name of the Buddha repeatedly, having this sort of a knee-jerk instinctual reaction, as soon as he felt himself being pulled up from under the cart, he freaked out and yelled, "Namo Buddhasa!" And the spirit with wrong view grabbing him was shocked and startled by this shouting, and scared, because he recognized the words, Namo Buddhasa, homage to the Buddha. And it had the power of waking him up to the extent that he realized that was a big mistake. Not just going after a living being, but going after someone who respected the Buddha invoking the Buddha's name like that, that's a source for great terror to anyone trying to harm such a being. The other spirit said, "See, what did I tell you? Now we're in big trouble." And so, feeling guilty about it, they changed their ways. And one of them, the one with right view, stood over the boy, guarding him, making sure that no other spirits came to bother him. The spirit with wrong view went into the city, into the king's palace, picked up the king's eating dish, a golden plate reserved for the king, filled it up with food, and brought it back to the boy. And together they fed the boy and gave him a lullaby and sent him to sleep and guarded over him all night. In the morning they wrote on this dish, the king's dish. They etched letters onto the dish explaining what they had done, and they put the dish on the cart so that it would be found. In the morning, the guards came and saw the young boy outside of the city gate under the cart, and they saw the king's dish sitting there on the cart and were disturbed by this and seized the boy as a thief. Said, "This is the king's dish." And they brought the boy before the king, and the king looked at the dish, read the letters that were etched onto it, and asked the boy, what does this mean? This is talk about spirits and protecting you and feeding you and taking my dish and feeding you from my dish. What's the meaning of this?" And the boy said, "I don't know. All I know is that last night my mother and father cared for me. They fed me and they protected me and guarded me all night." So the little boy had no knowledge of the spirits being there, just thought it was all a dream and that his parents were taking care of him. Eventually the mother and father came for the boy, and the king brought all three of them before the Buddha and asked the Buddha about this. "What is the meaning of this? Is this really the way, is this really true that just saying Namo Buddhasa will cause these spirits to completely change their ways and protect anyone against such unpleasant circumstances?" And the Buddha said, "Oh, great king, not only mindfulness of the Buddha, but there are 6 meditations that protect a person in this way." And he taught these 6 verses. So it's a bit of an odd story, relating to the power of words and touching upon the superstition that words possess, you know, that words evoke, the superstition that they evoke in people, the psychological power of words that we often would call superstition, where people would say these words have power, that this or that words or something else protect you from harm. So I think this is a story that it's hard for people to, who are not familiar with the existence of such spirits or the nature of such spirits, to hard for them to believe and to appreciate. So I don't really want to get into the details of spirits and their existence, but the important point of the story is the power of words, the psychological power that they have, which we usually would call superstition in most cases. And in most cases it would be superstition. There are examples of mantras, chants, invocations that are supposed to have in and of themselves power. That if you say these words in this order, this many times, something good will happen, or something bad won't happen. These words will protect you. Often people will say they will protect you from spirits, as exemplified by this story. But that's not really what's happening here, even by the story itself. The nature of these words is not that the words have power, but that their meaning has power. Anyone who invokes the name of the Buddha reminds the listener of something very powerful. So the story has two lessons for us about the power of words and the power of the Buddha. The first is the power that it has for oneself. So one aspect of protective chanting, protective words, is the psychological power it has for the person speaking. When you say something like Namo Buddhasa, or we can compare Namo Arahantasa, if you were to use it referring to someone outside of the Buddhist asana, like if you said praise to some other religious leader, this has psychological power. It has the power to strengthen one's mind, to give confidence. No matter what the words are, even if you just chanted nonsense, but if you had the confidence and the belief that those words have power, that of course has some superstitious element to it, some psychological power to give you confidence. And that confidence is not superstition, it's real. There's a reality, there's a real and true confidence that comes from speech. You can see this in the nature of vipassana meditation, in the cultivation of mindfulness. Simply saying to yourself, rising, falling, has the same sort of power, much less sort of romanticized or inspiring. There's nothing really inspiring about watching the stomach rise and fall. But there are absolutely elements of things like confidence and focus and reassurance that allow you to have confidence in reality, that free you from doubt. This is seen most especially when noting doubt itself, because doubt has the power to weaken the mind. So one can see for oneself simply by noting, doubting, the difference between allowing the mind to doubt and being reassured of the nature of even doubt. By simply saying to yourself, doubting, the mind becomes confident. As a result of that confidence, the doubt is dismissed. This is the power of mindfulness. It's a change of intention, a change in the way you look at and the way you approach, a change in approach to reality. Instead of trying to fix the details of a problem, something you doubt about, trying to solve your doubt, find an answer to your doubts, for example. You focus on the doubt itself and you see that the doubt is the problem, and you free yourself from the doubt without trying to solve the question of the thing that you were doubting. And this works with all of the hindrances. When there's greed, when you like something, the solution isn't to find a way to get what you like. The solution is to free yourself from the liking. Face the liking and see it as the problem. When you are mindful of the liking, you not only have confidence, you also have objectivity. And the objectivity is what does away with the liking. It also does away with disliking. But the point is that these are all powerful qualities. Qualities of objectivity, equanimity, confidence, even you can say wisdom is there. It's not immediately intuitive to recognize this as wisdom, but wisdom it is. When the stomach rises and you know that it's rising, we can call that wisdom. It means it's a mind that is clear, a mind that has clarity and truth and certainty and knowledge, that this is the stomach rising, or this is an experience of what we can call rising. It is that. There's no doubt, there's no uncertainty, there is knowledge. So all of these qualities are evoked from the right sorts of words. Saying something like Namo Buddhasa evokes those sorts of qualities because of the nature of the Buddha. But as I say, it could be any words, it could be nonsense. But because of what it means to you, it has that power. But then you have to address the difference between nonsense words or words that are praising something that is not worthy of praise versus praising something that is worthy of praise. And this has an effect both on the person speaking the words and the person listening. So why these sorts of words can be effective for towards, you know, spirits, ghosts, demons, I don't know, whatever might be there waiting to harass you. Is because of the effect that it has on the listener as well. So the effect on us, the effect on the listener, differs based on the object, based on the topic of the words. If the words relate to something that is meaningless or something that is not worthy of veneration, worthy of respect, there is a dissonance. It affects your level of confidence. It certainly affects all of the other qualities. You can't really say that there is wisdom in praising something that is not worthy of praise. But what makes homage to the Buddha so valuable and so important is that the Buddha truly was someone worthy of praise. That Buddha, even just the word Buddha, the meaning behind it, is of value, is of benefit. It's so powerful. Some people, even just hearing the word, would enter into a state of bliss and rapture, just hearing this word. There are stories of kings in the time of the Buddha who heard the word and couldn't believe that a Buddha had arisen. And it just was so enrapturing for them, just to hear the word Buddha. Did you say a Buddha? And they became paralyzed with bliss and emotion. The idea of a Buddha, someone who is awakened, someone who is enlightened, someone who is free from greed, free from anger, free from delusion. This is a very powerful idea, a powerful concept. It's something that is capable of bringing much more confidence than nonsense words or ordinary worldly words or words that are in veneration of something that isn't on the level of a Buddha. A Buddha who is free from greed, free from anger, free from delusion. A Buddha who is of complete purity, perfect wisdom, and has all the qualities that should resonate and provide someone with the highest sort of faith and confidence. People who come to Buddhism new and experience this practice of mindfulness of the Buddha can attest to this. When they pay homage to the Buddha, even just saying something like Namo Buddhasa, they can feel, they feel the reassurance, and it is supportive in their path and in their own appreciation and their own cultivation of good qualities. So you'll see in Buddhist cultures, in Buddhist societies, you'll see in Buddhist centers, Buddhist teachers quite often pass on this message of encouraging their students to venerate and pay respect to the Buddha, and more simply to remember the Buddha, have time to recollect on the Buddha, on his teachings, and remember the greatness of it. Not because it's something that they didn't know, but not for simply informational purposes, but for inspirational purposes. That recollecting the Buddha encourages you, inspires you. It sets your mind in a good way because of how great the Buddha was, how great the Dhamma is, and the greatness of the Sangha, what we aspire to, what we all wish to become, those who are worthy of appreciation, worthy of respect, worthy of homage, those who have purity and greatness and clarity of mind, those who are free from stress and suffering, those who have reached liberation from samsara. So the lesson we can get from the story is that it is a valuable practice to protect our spiritual life, our spiritual progress, to protect us in general, to from time to time use the Buddha as our refuge, not perhaps to win a game of whatever ball these kids were playing, And so not something that we should rely upon, not something we should rely on, but something that we should acknowledge is valuable in supporting our practice, in keeping us on track, if nothing else. That when we pay homage to the Buddha, it reminds us of good and bad and right and wrong. It reminds us of the path that we are on. It focuses our attention on what is right and what is good, and has valuable protective qualities to it because of how it affects us, affects our mind, and because of how it affects our listeners. It resonates with others. It resonates with spirits, apparently. There's a great power in the Buddha, psychologically and spiritually. The verses have a little bit of a different lesson to them. They're tangentially related to the story. The Buddha taught them because the king was asking about the value of mindfulness of the Buddha. And the Buddha pointed out there are six meditations that have this same sort of value to them. But first, the verses in general refer not to protective power, but they refer to being refer to the awakening quality. He says that those who follow the Buddha, those who listen to his teachings, are well awakened. That both day and night they have mindfulness. These are the aspects of all six verses that are the same. That someone who follows the Buddha is awake. And while others sleep and need a lot of sleep, what is remarkable about the followers of the Buddha is that they are awake. Diva cha ratto cha, day and night, mindful of these six things. So ordinary people need a lot of sleep, there's no question. People talk about sleep deprivation, getting enough sleep, and they have science to back them up that people need so many hours of sleep to whatever, to be healthy, to function, to be happy. And so it would be remarkable if someone could live with far less sleep. It seems too good to be true, perhaps. But if it were possible, wouldn't that be a good thing? No? If someone could have the same level of clarity of mind, or to be honest, actually a much greater clarity of mind, with far less sleep, wouldn't that seem like a miracle, a great thing? And so this is the remarkable quality of someone who follows the Buddha, that they are able to live with far less sleep. And it's not only at the same level of those who need a lot of sleep, not at all. The point is that people need so much sleep because of the defilements in their minds. Their minds are clouded. Their minds are caught up with greed, caught up with anger, delusion, fear, anxiety, stress, distraction, restlessness, conceit, pride, arrogance, all sorts of qualities that stress the mind, that pollute the mind, make the mind make it harder for the mind to function. And so it's not only that they live more tired and need more sleep, it's that even their waking hours have a far worse quality to them. Someone who frees themselves from these pollutants, someone who creates the clarity that allows them to see reality, see their experiences for what they are, without judgment, without reaction, without being triggered. Someone with a mind well focused, well tranquilized, someone with a mind in the present moment, seeing experiences as they are, without making more out of things than they actually are, live such a simple life, the mind so tranquil and so peaceful, that they don't need nearly as much sleep. Some people will, by day and by night, practice meditation without sleep. There are stories of monks doing this for months on end. In meditation centers, it is fairly common for people to just go without sleep, practicing day and night, because they are capable, because there is something special about their state of mind. So we take it as sort of a litmus test, a way of gauging your practice and your level of progress, how much sleep you actually need. We take it as a challenge and as a part, an aspect of our spiritual practice to cultivate the capacity to stay awake, not by forcing yourself, not through what you might call sleep deprivation, but through mental development to the extent that all of that sleep that you used to need is no longer necessary. This is probably the more important lesson of this, of these verses, a reminder of the importance or the greatness of being awake. Because of course when you're sleeping, not only is it the cause that is the problem, but the actual sleep itself of course makes it impossible to cultivate spiritual qualities, to do anything of any value. Sleeping many hours a day just means that many more hours of the day that you could be using for something else, preferably for the cultivation of mindfulness. Furthermore, the qualities that you develop through sleep make it more difficult to continue to progress when you wake up again. So through engaging in many hours of sleep, you find yourself having to reset and start over in the morning because of the many hours of progress that you've lost. But the idea is that there is great benefit and there is greatness in being awake. It's another name for Buddha, the word Buddha. Supabuddhang pabujanti. This is what this means, well awakened. So the word Buddha itself means one who is awake. But the other part of the verses is related to these six meditations. So the Buddha said that these six are to be identified as protective. And the first three, mindfulness of the Buddha, mindfulness of the Dhamma, mindfulness of the Sangha. When your mindfulness is focused always on the Buddha, always on the Dhamma, always on the Sangha, this is something that protects the mind and relates to one's being awake. So someone who is awake has the quality of reflecting on these three things. So mindfulness of the Buddha and the Dhamma and the Sangha are, generally speaking, considered protective meditations, things that we should all acknowledge and be made aware of as protective meditations. Even during our practice of mindfulness of the four Satipatthana, we can take time in our day to reflect on the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. Not obsessively or not systematically, but as a side practice to cultivate this sort of encouragement when we're feeling discouraged, unsure about ourselves, when we are losing hope or confidence, when we feel lazy or complacent, we can remember the Buddha and be inspired. We can remember the Dhamma and remember the greatness that we are engaged in. How great is this practice that we now have the opportunity to cultivate, to engage in? When we think about the Sangha, we remember the people who have cultivated this practice and remind ourselves that this is not something that we're doing alone. We're not the first person to do this. This is a part of a long lineage, a long tradition of the cultivation of greatness. We are on a path that is the path of the noble ones, the path that the Buddha and all of his disciples have followed. We have this lineage, and we can be reassured and confident that we are on a good path based on our connection with the Sangha, on a recollection of their greatness, those who have followed this path. The fourth is one that we've talked about recently. It's the same words the Buddha says again, nityang kaya gata sati. Kaya gata sati often refers to mindfulness of the parts of the body, the hair, the body hair, the nails, the teeth, the skin, the flesh, and so on. For the purpose of cultivating an appreciation of the non-beautiful nature of the body, for eradicating our lust, physical desire for bodily pleasures, for sexual pleasures, and so on. Attraction to the body, attraction to the physical body. When you focus on the parts of the body, this helps you overcome that. So that is a protective meditation that is very much acknowledged. Protection against lust, protection against addiction to sensual desires, and so on. But it can also, of course, refer to mindfulness of the body in general, as opposed to mindfulness of the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, which focus on concepts. Mindfulness of the body is the entrance, as I've said, to the practice of vipassana. When you take the four satipatthana as your object, you always start with the body. This is why we focus on the stomach rising and falling, or we focus on the foot moving, stepping right, stepping left. This is as an entryway to guide us towards mindfulness of the four satipatthana. As we focus on the body, we start to see vedana, we see citta, we see dhamma, we see all of the aspects of experience, and are able to comprehensively investigate and understand and gain clarity and wisdom about the nature of reality. So it can be seen in two ways. Mindfulness of the body in general is a quality that the followers of the Buddha are universally skilled and proficient in. The fifth is ahimsa. The Buddha says, ahimsaya rato mano, the mind that delights in harmlessness. And the commentary says this refers to compassion, because harmlessness means not the opposite of cruelty. So the ordinary mind wishes to harm other beings, harm one's enemies, those who are antagonistic. One has bad intentions towards them. So an inspiring quality of those who follow the Buddha, something that allows them to be free from the pollutions of the mind that make them tired and keep them asleep, is their harmlessness, their delight in harmlessness. They leap at the opportunity to be compassionate for others. They immediately incline towards freeing other people from suffering. When they see others in harm's way, when they see others victim of suffering, they think of all the ways that they can free that person from suffering. They do whatever they can. They delight in freeing others from suffering, at least to the extent of not harming. So freeing them from the suffering that we might cause. Not killing, not stealing, not verbally abusing others. This, of course, is a very important protection, because those who are inclined otherwise are psychologically vulnerable to their own hatred and the ill will that would consume them otherwise. But also vulnerable to revenge. When others become aware of our bad intentions, or when we act on our bad intentions and are then subject to revenge, to vengeance. We become trapped in the cycle of vengeance. And the sixth is interesting. The Buddha, the verse just says, bhavanaya rato mano, the mind that delights in bhavana, which is mental development, or another word for meditation. But the commentary, probably rightly so, identifies this as metta bhavana. It says that there are many types of bhavana, but here what is meant is metta. Friendliness, kindness. And this fits well with compassion. If we say that the fifth one refers to compassion, well, the the accompanying meditation that goes along with compassion is, of course, kindness, friendliness. And the difference between the two, compassion is the desire for others to be free from suffering, but kindness is the inclination towards others being happy. So with compassion, you are looking to free others from suffering, at least to the extent of not causing them suffering yourself. But with metta, you're actively inclined towards other people's happiness, at least to the extent of being friendly and assisting them or applying yourself to the to their benefit when appropriate. So they're like two sides of the same coin, but they are two qualities that you find in those who have become awake, that they have no ill will, which would be the opposite of kindness, and they have no thoughts of cruelty, which would be the opposite of compassion. Again, an important protection because of how it creates harmony and friendliness, because of how it allows you to interact with others without discord, without animosity, which we normally find when we're triggered by and annoyed by the behavior of others, when we're disappointed or disturbed or upset by the activities of other people. Kindness, compassion are a protection for us in our relationships with others, allowing us to continue on our way undisturbed and allowing us to be friendly and in harmony with those who could support us on our path. You know, our friends and family, being in harmonious relationships with them, our fellows in the spiritual life, to be free from the discord that that affects so many meditation centers, monasteries. When we remember these qualities and apply ourselves to them, it's like night and day when we're able to live in harmony, as opposed to allowing ourselves to get upset and cultivate animosity towards our fellows, and cultivate animosity to those around us. It's a protection, of course, spiritually, and it's a protection physically, meaning it protects our minds because it keeps us at peace, keeps us from cultivating hatred and holding grudges against others. And physically it protects us because it protects our relationships, our interactions with others, frees us from the trouble that comes from acrimonious relationships. So these six, among other meditations, are six meditations that protect a person. But another way of looking at it, and I think the lesson for us, is to talk about these things in this way, as a means of reminding ourselves of the qualities that relate to the cultivation of mindfulness. That not only can each of these six be practiced in isolation, you can practice mindfulness of the Buddha as a meditation subject, and that can support you, that can protect you, that can increase your spiritual well-being. But it's not the way to become enlightened, it's not the true way to become awakened. So the way the Buddha phrases this, he talks about the reasons why someone who follows the Buddha might be protected. And one of the reasons is because they are in constant connection with the Buddha. Not necessarily because they are actively thinking about the Buddha, but because of their quality of mind, they are, you could say, one with the Buddha. They see the Buddha phrased it this way. They see the Buddha because they see the Dhamma. They are in tune with the Buddha because of their qualities of mind. They are awake and both day and night, they are one with the Buddha. One with the Dhamma, one with the Sangha. Their mindfulness is constantly on the Buddha because it's constantly on the Dhamma. Even if you're not thinking about the teachings that are in books, when you're focused on reality, even just watching the stomach rise and fall, when you focus on feelings, when you focus on thoughts, when your mind is clearly aware of the experiences that you're having here and now, not delving into the past or worrying about the future, getting caught up in cerebral concepts, when you're just here and now experiencing seeing as seeing, hearing as hearing, and feeling as feeling, thinking as thinking. This is being in touch with the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. So when someone talks about recollecting the Buddha, the greatest reflection or recollection of the Buddha is the recollection of the Dhamma. When you're in touch with the Dhamma, when you're in tune with the reality of experience, then you can say you truly see the Buddha. And of course, mindfulness of the body is a description of someone who practices well and follows the Buddha's teachings, because they're in tune with the body. The body, that which is here, that which we experience. When walking, they know they're walking. When standing, they know they're standing. No matter what they do, even when lying down at night, they lie down with mindfulness and they're mindful of the lying posture rather than just falling off to sleep. And the fifth and sixth, that rather than actively trying to artificially construct these qualities of mind, a person who has cultivated clarity and purity and purified their mind from greed, anger, and delusion will consistently be in a state, day and night, of non-harming and kindness. Their kindness will know no bounds. They will have a quality of kindness and friendliness, free from any desire to harm others or to remove the happiness that other people have gained from them. Wishing all beings to be happy, all beings to be free from suffering, having no ulterior motives, no desire to manipulate others, no desire to harm or oppress others. With a mind that is completely free from such pollutants, It's a remarkable quality of those that follow the Buddha, that they have purity of kindness and purity of compassion at all times, without having to specifically force it on themselves, without having to actively or consciously cultivate it. They have it as a matter of course because of the nature of their minds, being free from greed, free from anger, and free from delusion. So our lesson is, of course, to continue to cultivate mindfulness, but to have a sense of the qualities that we're striving for and the qualities that we're seeking, and a sense that through the cultivation of mindfulness, through creating purity of mind, a mind that is objective and clear, we gain so much. And we gain such great protection. We can be truly said to be someone who knows the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. Someone who is kind and compassionate and pure and present, living in the body instead of living in the cerebral aspects of our mind, in conceptual reality. So, if we're looking for protection, if you're trying to find the greatest protection, of course the greatest protection is mindfulness, but it's because the greatest protection is the Buddha Sasana. We worship and we pay reverence and pay homage to the Buddha as a matter of course, not just through our words like Namo Buddhasa that might be greatly powerful and protective, but also through our practice of the Buddha's teaching, which allows us to really have a true sense of reverence and appreciation for truth, reality, purity, goodness, and freedom from suffering. So that's the Dhammapada for today. Thank you for listening.